Hi everyone, and thank you for joining us on another episode of Lid Publishing's podcast, Lid Radio. My name is Miro, and as always, I will be your host for today's show. With me today is the author of The Little Black Book of Decision-Making, Michael Nicholas. How are you today, Michael?
Yes, I'm very well, and thank you very much for inviting me on.
It is an absolute pleasure to have you here on the podcast, and we are very much looking forward to this conversation. But of course, as we get started, my first question for you is, give us a brief description of the book and what inspired you to become an author.
Well, the thing that inspired me to become an author was a few years ago, because this is actually my third book. And really, it was a question of how do you differentiate in this marketplace? You know, it was as simple as that when I was starting out in coaching, and there's so many coaches, you start thinking, well, how do I not just look like everybody else? So that was the original impetus, if you like. But many years have gone by since then, and this particular book was actually inspired by the publisher, John Wiley & Sons, approaching me as a recognized expert in the field and asking me to write the book, which obviously was great from my perspective. And then the question was, well, how do you write a book that's different? Because there's lots of books on the market already. Because of the pace of change and the increase in uncertainty and ambiguity in the marketplace, some of those approaches that we used to use are less effective than they used to be. And so now we're starting to need another way of decision making, if you like, one which is much more based on creativity than problem solving. And the problem here is a sort of paradox, because we need expertise, and we need knowledge, and we need to have been across the field to embed the learning at the level that's necessary for creativity. But the parts of the brain that do that can introduce errors without us realizing it. And so the essential question of the book is, how do you improve your capacity to make decisions in a fast-moving, uncertain environment, building the mental capability to do that without also introducing the inherent errors involved in that sort of decision-making?
That's very fascinating, and something that always stuck out for me when it comes to decision-making is that it is something we do subconsciously, and we don't even realize when we do it every single day. Can you tell us perhaps why is that happening, and how can we actually gain control of it?
Yeah, well, the reason it's happening is because we have to make so many decisions. And if you think about it, many of our decisions are so subtle that we wouldn't even really recognize them as a decision. But what color socks shall I wear today, or do I wash my face or do my teeth first? Which side of the bed do I get out of, potentially? These decisions, they're all decisions, but we don't think about them in the way we would normally consider a decision. And they're all taken care of at unconscious levels, because they have to be. Because if we had to think about decisions at that level, what we would find is that we wouldn't be able to function in the world. And this is actually what research has found with people who've experienced some sort of brain injury, where they lose access to the subtle emotional cues that inform those minor decisions. What they find is these people can't make any decision. It's completely debilitating. So we know that every decision we make has this sort of underlying strata of information from our emotions, which informs us. But of course, in the modern world, especially in business, much of the decision making we would think of as rational, and we would want to be able to have logical justifications for the decisions we make. And then we get this sort of trade-off between the two, or the question, which is better, the rational, logical, or this intuitive, creative gut instinct? And the simple answer to that is neither. We need both. We need both because each is effective in different circumstances. And so your original question, I think, Mauro, was can you control that instinctive aspect?
Yes.
Well, no, you can't. What you can do is you can learn to recognize it and make it more effective. And the reason you can't control it is because it's unconscious. And by definition, we can't control what's happening in the unconscious. All we can do is try to make it more conscious so that we get an ability to make conscious decisions around it.
Right. And the two branches when it comes to decision making, reasoning and intuition, as you've explained to us, are very important, and they work together. Now, my initial question was, is one perhaps more important than the other? But after listening to your answer, I guess my question would be, in terms of a business decision making and on a business sense, can one perhaps overpower the other or prove to be more effective?
Well, definitely one can be more effective, but the answer to that is a flexibility, because neither one is more effective under all circumstances. So the starting point of the book actually is to understand how context needs to impact decision making, and particularly the level of complexity and ambiguity in the environment. Because if you're not considering that question, then what will happen is we fall back on the second question you ask, which is, can one overpower the other? And most of us will tend to have a natural inclination towards one or the other. I'll often ask at the start of a workshop who considers themselves to be a rational decision maker and who considers themselves to be largely intuitive and who considers themselves to be a bit of both. And you'll usually get hands to all three of those questions. And for the people who are a bit of both, then I'll ask them, well, how do you know which to use? And the answer to that, of course, is, well, it's intuitive, right, which brings us to the same problem, whichever way you look at it, which is that we're relying on our instinct to determine which approach we take. And when we're doing that, it's very unlikely that our instinct will be wrong at times.
Yes, and there is something that we often struggle with and are at odds with, and that is our gut feeling. That's something which is absolutely part of us, but we are often in struggle. What are the triggers behind gut feelings, and can we really trust it?
Well, the trigger, there's various thinking on this, and of course we don't really know is the honest answer, because what's unconscious we can't look at, but it can be studied. And what we find is that our gut feeling is really giving us an indicator of what we know but don't know we know. So we're forming a feeling based on a set of unconscious evaluations around the situation we're facing. And some of the aspects of that situation we may not have consciously be aware of, because the level of complexity is too great for our conscious mind to get around. So we'll get a gut feel. And then the question is, do you trust your gut feel or not? And, you know, sometimes our gut feel will be right. And I'm sure we've all had experiences where our gut has told us one thing and our rational mind tells us another. And we've gone with the rational mind and realized that the gut was right, or vice versa. You know, sometimes we go with our gut and it proves to be wrong. And then we think, well, I should have gone with my analysis, you know. And that's the problem. It's like, how do you know when the gut intuition is wrong? Because what our unconscious mind is doing here is reaching a conclusion based on a set of information we can't really evaluate. And what it wants to do is look back into the past for examples that have been similar, and then use that to project forward from the current situation to say, how do I expect this current scenario or set of circumstances I'm facing to evolve? And then one of the big findings of psychology of the last 30 years is what happens next, which is that we then make our decision based on what we expect to happen next. So this is quite an important realization, because most of us feel as though we make our decisions based on what's happening now. But the truth is, we take what's happening now, we project that forward based on some assumptions about, you know, past patterns we've seen, or if we've never seen anything like it before, we'll make something up because our brain wants to understand. And we create a scenario for the future, and we make our decision based on that scenario of what we think will happen next. And so it will only be appropriate then, based on how accurate that intuition is. And one of the real problems of that intuitional gut feel is that we get no warning bell when it's wrong. So we can feel as though we're right, our gut tells us we're right, and yet we can be at the same moment completely diametrically wrong. So it's, how do you deal with that, really?
Yeah, that's very interesting. And actually, there is a point there that you mentioned, and that is our history. And although we in a way, project an outcome for the future. Something that really sticks out for me, and that's a bit of a nerdy thing to say on my side, but I quite enjoy evolutional psychology and the way it works. So I guess a bit of an offbeat question for me personally would be, is there any factor in the way that we've evolved over time, whether it is in our, for example, fight or flight process, or anything that is beyond, let's say, our everyday experiences that may actually trigger a gut feeling or any other symptoms?
Well, that will be one of the biggest, if not the biggest, factor that affects our gut. Because at the most primary level, at least this is the current theory, and it seems to make sense to me, the most basic thing our mind is constantly doing is asking the question, am I safe or not? It's our survival instinct. So every person we meet, our mind is going friend or foe. And we will do that evaluation very, very quickly. In fact, some of the recent research has indicated that we're forming that first impression somewhere between a 20th and a 10th of a second after we meet people.
Wow.
So that's how important it is. And the parts of our brain that do that are very fast. They're very automatic. They're completely unconscious. And they'll also give us no indication whether we're right or not. It just feels right. So we're making those decisions, friend or foe, am I safe in this situation, incredibly quickly. And the fight-flight mechanism that you mentioned, our threat response, which actually isn't truly a response, if we think about a response as being something where we have an element of conscious choice, they're truly a reaction. And that reaction is basically designed to mobilize energy to literally fight or run for our lives. And it happens in about a tenth of the time that we can think. So in other words, we've had that gut feel or that instinctive reaction to something, especially that triggers our fight-flight mechanism, before we've even had time to think about it. And what that does is it changes the emotional environment inside us so that now the way that we evaluate the situation we're facing will be through the lens, if you like, of that emotion. In other words, we will tend to interpret what's happening consistently with the with that internal experience that we're having. And this, of course, explains the whole thing around phobics. When people have a phobia, we all know that phobia is an irrational level of fear to an external, to some sort of external stimulus. So, you know, it's not the very real fear that we would feel if we were walking through a jungle and we came across a lion. It's walking into a room and seeing a spider on the wall.
Right.
Or as someone told me one time in a workshop, when I asked if anyone had a phobia, his phobia was butterflies and moths. And I said, can you give me a reason as an example? And he said, yeah, I was having dinner with some friends, and about 20 minutes into the meal, I noticed that there was a moth on the wall near us. To which I said, well, I expect the meal didn't taste too good after that. And he said, I couldn't eat after that. Now, that's a real phobia, you know, when the moth is on the wall and the level of fear that it's stimulating, no matter how irrational, is causing him to not want to eat. And that comes back to the evolutionary bit that you mentioned, Myra, because the reason we don't want to eat when our fight-flight mechanism is triggered to that degree is because when we were running or fighting, there was no need for food. We literally, it doesn't come into the survival equation. So therefore, we would prioritize other activities. And that's what happens. So yes, the fight-flight in particular, the reactivity around that will cause us to lose our ability to think clearly about the situation, because it's triggering parts of the brain that then override our thinking capabilities, because they're literal. Their whole purpose is survival, and that requires very fast action.
That is some fascinating stuff there. And actually, I would like to focus on the decision-making itself with my next question, because the state that we're in when we make good decisions is actually, in my opinion, one of the most important things. And in my personal experience, I find that the worst thing to do when I'm hungry is to actually walk into a restaurant, because you always tend to order more than what you would. And I think I've realized in my time, at least, that making a decision when you're perhaps sleepy, hungry, or tired ends up being more negative or not. Is there an ideal state that we can achieve before making good decision making?
Yeah, well, if we link that back to what I was just talking about, the fight flight mechanism, what the fight flight mechanism will cause essentially is that we act on instinct. And so there are certain times when instinct is very valuable. If we've trained ourselves to do something well, then those instinctive processes are actually an essential part of our of what you might call high performance or mastery. You know, if you think about a professional tennis player, there's no time to consciously think about hitting the ball where they want to hit it. It has to be very instinctive. And the reason they can do that well is because they've trained those unconscious brain capabilities to take over. But the question is, what happens in decision making where that fight flight is triggering at times when we need to use the part of the brain that enables us to rationalize and think clearly? And the answer there is that the amygdala is the part of the brain that triggers the fight flight. It also suppresses the part of our brain that's responsible for rational decision making, a part of the brain called the prefrontal cortex. And so when we're stressed because the fight flight mechanism has been activated, then the part of our brain that we need in order to make good decisions, that any sort of decision that involves conscious thought, is going to be significantly suppressed. And that's going to reduce our ability to make reliable decisions.
Right, and I'd like to focus a bit on the business sense of what we've been talking about. And can you perhaps give us some sort of errors or issues with decision making when it comes to leadership? Is there any sort of pattern that you've observed yourself which often can get in the way?
Well, leadership is much like any other area of life, which is, you know, you can't be a great leader if you're having to use a lot of conscious thought about everything, because there are too many aspects to it. The unconscious aspects of how we prioritize our time, for example. So one of the questions I get asked very regularly by clients or asked to help with is their work-life balance. They're literally spending too many hours at the office, and they'll say, you know, I've got young children. I want to be spending more time at home with them. But at the moment, I don't seem to be able to free up the time to do it. And you can talk about the reasons why they're prioritizing the time the way they are. And they can understand it. And they say, right, I need to make some different choices. And yet the same behaviors will continue. I've seen this so many times where people want to change their work-life balance, and yet whatever they do, they seem to still be making the same decisions in relationship to how many hours they spend in the office. Just one example. And so you'll find below the surface, if you dig deeper, there must be a deeper driver, because if they're in the office, it's because that's what they want to be doing. That seems to be, for them, the thing they're valuing most, or the thing that they're prioritizing most highly. And so usually you need to go deeper. So if it's a leader, then one of the reasons that they may be spending time in the office is maybe they feel like they can't delegate any more to their team, or despite the fact they believe they're a good delegator, their team still require a lot of their time to get this work done. And I'll just give one example of how this may play out with a client of mine who is the managing director of a business whose work life was out of balance and who believed that she was a great delegator. And so we'd explored this and not really been able to find any ways that she would be able to spend less time in the office. And in the end, I literally said, well, do you mind if I look through your diary and let's see if there's any patterns I can recognize that you can't see because you're too close to it? And it turned out that she had a lot of time one-on-one with her team. So I said, well, can you tell me why that is? And she said, well, just because they like to review major decisions with me before they make them. Well, clearly at that point, that could be the truth, or it could be something that's not quite true, but is her interpretation of a situation. So my job as a coach is to test that sort of statement. So I said, OK, so if what you're saying is true, then when you go on holiday, there'd be no bottleneck. People wouldn't need to be waiting for you to come back in order to make the decisions. Is that true? And to her credit, with great honesty, she thought about that. And the next words out of her mouth were very interesting, because after a very long pause, she said, "If I do what you're suggesting." Now, clearly, I hadn't suggested anything. I just asked a question. Is that true?
Right.
So her own mind must have answered that question and gone, actually, no, that's not true. Why is that not true? And now she's started to explore what the real driver is about why she's having these meetings. And she's discovered something completely different. And this is what it was. She said, if that's true, if I do what you're suggesting, what does the business need me for? So now we see the real driver, that she's wanting to get involved in these decisions because she feels that's how she justifies her position as the leader of the business. And she will always continue to do that until she understands or has some ideas about how to add at least that much value, but preferably significantly more, without doing that, what's essentially micromanagement of her team. So we then have spent some time talking about, well, how could you add more value doing things that only you can do? And once we'd identified some areas where she could do that, she went off and took those challenges on automatically. There was no period of transition, because now she wanted to do that. And suddenly it freed her up and her work-life balance changed. And she actually texted me a couple of years after we finished working together, one New Year's Eve, and she said, "I've been reflecting on the work we did together. And I want to tell you that the biggest change in my life has been the improvement in my relationship with my husband." And yet we never talked about her relationship with her husband. All we talked about was the things that were causing her to spend too much time in the office. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And it would seem that once she made the conscious decision making of changing that, it had a rolling impact on the rest of her life.
Exactly. So what we had to do, and this comes back to one of my favorite quotes, actually, from Carl Jung, the famous psychologist. He said, "Until we make the unconscious conscious, it will rule our lives and we'll call it fate."
And that is a great quote.
It is. And we'll always find, I mean, I don't think there's any circumstance I've ever worked with anybody where you couldn't dig deeper into understanding what's the real motivator for this behavior. There's a superficial level understanding, but there'll be something deeper that people are trying to achieve. And so when you uncover that unconscious driver, which is actually driving so many superficial level decisions, all those superficial things start to just change automatically. And there have been some fascinating studies done on this. There was a study out of the University of Hertfordshire where literally they were just looking at behavioral change around habits. And the study participants were asked three times a week, to identify something that they did fairly habitually. In other words, the decision making around it was unconsciously driven. And to choose for a day to do something different to that habit. And of course, what that is doing constantly is making that decision conscious. So it's making the decision to do that habitual behavior conscious. And once it's conscious, you can do something different. And so now they start to make different choices. And the really interesting thing about this study was that over the study period, which I think was 8 weeks, on average, the study participants lost 8 pounds in weight.
Wow.
And yet none of them were actually actively trying to lose weight. What was happening is they were becoming more consciously aware of the unconscious decisions they were making. And in doing that, part of that broader picture, as you've just described, was they're realizing how much unconscious eating they do and how many times they're making a choice to eat something that wasn't really serving them. And with that greater conscious awareness, could now make a new choice. And just from doing that, they started losing weight.
That is fascinating, and especially when it comes to food, and if we do have, you know, busy calendars and schedules, it's very easy to get into a cycle where you wouldn't even know that you're taking a lot more calories than you think you are.
Definitely. And if you watch any of the programs on TV with these people who are carrying a lot of extra weight, where they start off by making a food diary, and and the amount of shock they have when they realize quite how much they eat is consistent, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost like a slap, and and also I think the fact that you see it in front of you gives a very different impact to just maybe perhaps thinking, well, I might be eating a bit too much, maybe, but if it is presented in front of you, then that's a different picture. And my last question I would like to ask you, Michael, is the one I ask everyone on the podcast, and that is, what are you currently reading?
Well, I'm always reading many things, to be honest. the book list is long. So there's always some books I'm reading about the brain. There's a couple of books, The Male Brain and The Female Brain, I've been reading recently. There's a lot of stuff I read about how we form our models of what we would call reality. But of course, in the book, there's a chapter called The Reality Delusion, because what we perceive as reality isn't really reality. It's just something we've interpreted through our own model. So there's a book I'm reading at the moment called What is Reality? Quite a range, actually.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. And actually, to our listeners, we'll include a link in the description below where you can go and find out more about that book as well. But with that, I would like you to thank you very much for joining us today, Michael. It's been a great conversation and very enlightening.
Lovely. Thank you very much.
And of course, to our listeners, if you would like to know more about what we talked about today and a book, links will be in the description below where you can find out more about Michael and his work. And the book, we once again thank you very much for joining us this week, and we look forward to seeing you next week on Lid Radio.